Welcome back to Audio Notes. I'm Dmitry Atapin.
And I'm Haeyeon Park, and we're thrilled to welcome you to the sixth program of the Music in Menlo 2025 season, Constellations Ensemble Magic, the program titled Let's Add Voices.
In David Finkel's words, the human voice, the most natural instrument, has inspired chamber music for centuries, bringing melodic beauty and the unique musicality of languages. This program celebrates the voice as the ideal chamber collaborator.
We open with Carl Maria von Weber's Scottish national songs, arrangements reflecting his fascination with folk traditions beyond Germany. Brahms's two songs for mezzo-soprano, viola, and piano follow. And Samuel Barber's Dover Beach comes next, a haunting setting for baritone and string quartet, meditating on human isolation against the backdrop of the eternal sea. Brett Dean's And Once I Played Ophelia offers a striking contemporary take.
We close with Leonard Bernstein's arias and barcaroles, a witty and personal collection of songs for mezzo-soprano, baritone, and piano four hands. Along the way, we are thrilled to feature three superb guests, soprano Tony Arnold, mezzo-soprano Marie-Thérèse Carmack, and baritone John Moore. Now, before we touch on the different pieces of our program, we wanted to share our conversation with John Moore on the subject of singing in a concert setting.
The beauty of the concert hall recital chamber music when vocalists are allowed in the room is that you have to serve the words, and the words are the focus. I love singing opera, but the acting and the costumes, that can be distracting. In the recital hall, when a singer is confined to that space on the stage, the words have to do all of that. And people are forced to pay attention in a different way. You get rid of the distraction. It's actually a benefit. For me, the storytelling is the most important part. It starts with utterance. It starts with language and builds from there. And so stripping away as much distraction as possible so that we can listen together to storytelling is the value. And there's a ton of acting that goes on in simple hand gestures and in just the look in a singer's eyes.
Who loves not a soldier, the generous, the brave, and heart that can feel and the arm that can save. In peace, the gay friend with the manners that charm, the thought ever liberal, the soul ever warm.
We open with Carl Maria von Weber's Scottish National Songs, Opus 108. You may recall hearing Weber's dazzling clarinet quintet in Concert Program 4, Quintessential Quintets, a perfect showcase of his flair for virtuosity and expressive melody. But now we turn to a very different side of this German composer. Born in 1786, Weber is best known today as a pioneer of romantic opera, especially for his masterpiece Der Freischütz. Yet near the end of his life, just a year before his death, he took on an unexpected project, a set of Scottish folk song arrangements for voice and chamber ensemble. In 1825, Weber was commissioned by British impresario and publisher George Thompson, the same man who had earlier enlisted Haydn and Beethoven for similar projects, to arrange traditional Scottish tunes for publication. Weber's Scottish national songs treat these folk melodies with elegance and classical romantic polish. Like many composers of the early 19th century, Weber was fascinated by the national character of folk music. His arrangements preserve the charm and spirit of the original tunes while enhancing them with expressive harmony, sophisticated textures, and a strong sense of drama. The scoring for baritone voice, flute, violin, cello, and piano adds vivid timbral color and a uniquely intimate atmosphere. Rather than accompanying the voice from a distance, the ensemble participates in a rich musical dialogue, supporting and responding to the singer with great character. We asked baritone John Moore, who will be performing these songs at the festival, to share his thoughts on the experience of singing with this unusual and colorful chamber ensemble.
The thing I like about the way it's set, the piano continues to drive it throughout. And then you get the three instruments filling it out, but not overwhelming it. When you get these sort of march-like martial themes. It feels folky in a way that it wouldn't if it's like a full band. There's plenty of room in the piece for the instruments to show. Each individually, the flute obviously is quite interesting to have available to us and to hear in that context. But, you know, I always tell people that it's really great to be a singer. It's nice to be out front. It's nice to have the words, but the best musicians are always behind me or around me. And it's really that instrumentation that fills everything out in such a way that makes the words make sense. So I always like these smaller groups, like what we get with a chamber ensemble. I feel like people can really lean into the individual instrumentalists as much as they might lean into the singer. And we get to hear each unique voice. And certainly these four songs do a really good job of showing everybody off and telling a beautiful story. Because you have multiple verses, it's the same tune, but you're trying to convey a different thing with each verse. And so in the chamber setting, it's so much more fun because it's easier to listen to each other and to find the nuance in each verse. But every piece offers an opportunity for us to find multiple ways of expressing the character of each verse and each song.
Four selected songs from the set will be performed in Music in Menlo. The first, The Troubadour, features a text by none other than Sir Walter Scott. The poem evokes the romantic figure of the wandering minstrel, a symbol of freedom, artistic expression, and heroic melancholy that was central to 19th century art and literature. Weber's setting pairs Scott's noble verse with a graceful Scottish air, allowing both the poetry and the folk melody to shine. Here's what John Moore shared about this song.
I love this idea, the troubadour. You get this sense of what someone's fighting for. That's not only national, homeland kind of warrior mentality, but also fighting for love. So it's local and national. I love that. And it's idealistic. When you have one of the great poets and you get a real sense of national pride.
Troubadour that hated sorrow beneath his lady's window came, and thus he sung his last good morrow. My arm it is, my country's right, my heart is in my true love's power, gaily for love and fame to.
The second selection, in the Scottish language, O Poortit Cald, or O Cold Poverty, is a poignant setting of a poem by Robert Burns. This song is a tender reflection on love and hardship, celebrating emotional resilience in the face of economic struggle. Burns' verses remind us that true love holds greater worth than material wealth, and Weber's setting beautifully enhances that sentiment with warmth and subtlety. Set to a traditional Scottish melody, the arrangement showcases Weber's ability to adapt it.
Well, Poortit Cald is really interesting to me because it's a beautiful setting. It's a really serious matter that love is really real. And love, no matter what, you fight for it, you'll do anything to defend it. But poverty makes it extraordinarily difficult. And so it's really a humbling piece of music in terms of the text. To be honest, I remember the first time learning it, I was learning notes and rhythms and language because it's old English, but I didn't really get it until after I sang it. And then I went back and it's the text. It's despairing in a way that like love can't be fully expressed because you're living day to day in sort of this state of want and need. And that again, it's a universal theme.
Poortit Cald and restless love, ye wreck my peace between ye. Yet Poortit I could forgive if 'twere not for.
The next song, A Soldier Am I, draws on a traditional Scottish tune and a patriotic text to create a bold, energetic tribute to the soldier's life. Marked by themes of duty, courage, and national pride, the song celebrates both personal valor and the strength of communal identity. Faber's arrangement matches the spirit of the text with rhythmic vigor and martial flair. The baritone voice delivers the declamatory lines with commanding presence, while the chamber ensemble adds embellishments and military style flourishes that echo drum patterns and battlefield fanfares.
A Soldier Am I. I love this piece because, like in the Mozart operas, there's always some sort of march. And then there's always these dance themes. And like Le Nozze di Figaro, at the end of Act One, you get this martial dance that grows out of the very personal drama going on the estate of Count Almaviva. But what was that intention? Why was he putting it in there? Well, if you've got a quarter of the audience are the aristocrats, and then the rest of the audience are the regular people, you throw a march in there, and everyone suddenly feels this sense of pride of the nation. And in this song, we get a sense of that with the martial themes and certainly the talking about how the soldiers feel about that and then how the townspeople feel about that and then how the veterans feel about having the soldiers come into the town and how they feel nostalgic for the days when they fought hard and went into battle. And it's just like a really beautiful, in this short little song, you really get a sense of what made civilization, what made communities thrive, and what made people proud of where they come from.
A soldier am I, all the world o'er I range, and would not my lot with a monarch exchange. How welcome the soldier wherever he roves, attended like Venus and Mars and the Loves.
How tall is... The last selection is a tender and timeless All My Love's Like the Red, Red Rose, set to one of the most famous poems by Robert Burns. This song compares deep affection to a blooming rose in June, capturing both the freshness of youthful love and the enduring beauty of lifelong devotion. Weber's setting embraces the pastoral simplicity of the original while elevating it with warm harmonies and lyrical restraint.
Red, Red Rose, Robert Burns, again, you'd have one of the great poems. It's just pure love. Till the seas gang dry, my dear, and the rocks melt with the sun, I will love thee still, my dear, while the sands of life shall run. It's the thing that makes you swoon, and that's always good music.
After these beautiful and varied expressions of Scottish song through Weber's refined lens, we now move into the world of high romanticism with Johannes Brahms's two songs for mezzo-soprano, viola, and piano. An intimate and heartfelt pairing that explores love, longing, and the rich sonorities of voice and viola intertwined. Before we explore the details of this work, we wanted to share a reflection from violist Paul Neubauer. He spoke about the unique relationship between the viola and the human voice, and how, as an instrumentalist, he always seeks to emulate vocal expression.
I love working with the voice because we want to sound like a singer, and singers want to sound like instrumentalists. It's very odd that we all want to do what the other person does. But for an instrumentalist, I'm always telling my students, how would you sing this? Sing this passage for me. We want it to sound like you're singing in the most natural way. And that's what the voice you naturally do, or you hope. It's going to be shaped in a certain way when you sing it, which is quite a bit harder on the instrument sometimes to achieve that. So to have that in your ear is very helpful for your rendering of a work.
These two songs are Brahms's only example of vocal chamber music, a rare union of voice, viola, and piano. Richly expressive and deeply personal, they were composed for Brahms's lifelong friend, the violinist Joseph Joachim, and Joachim's contralto wife, Amalia Schneeweis. although interestingly, the two pieces were written nearly two decades apart. To complement Amalia's warm voice, Brahms chose the viola instead of the violin, not only for its darker, more intimate sound, but also because Joachim was a skilled violist as well. The result is a deeply blended, resonant texture where the viola doesn't merely accompany the voice, but breathes and phrases with it as an equal partner. Brahms composed the first of the two, Geistliches Wiegenlied, or Sacred Lullaby, in 1864 as a wedding gift for Josef and Amalia, and presented a reworked version in 1865 on the occasion of the birth of their first child, whom the couple named Johannes in Brahms's honor. Nearly 20 years later, in 1883, Brahms composed Gestillte Sehnsucht, or Longing at Rest, at a time when the Joachim's marriage was deeply troubled. Brahms, ever loyal to both friends, hoped the gift of this music might help mend the rift between them. Although reconciliation was not to be, he published the two songs together in 1884, in reverse order of composition, as Opus 91.
Well, as we call them, the Brahms songs, they're so luscious and tender and intimate and dramatic. Everything is in these songs.
The first published piece in the set, Longing at Rest, is set to a poem by Friedrich Rückert. The text contemplates the calming influence of nature on the soul and expresses a yearning for release, a nostalgia for peace, both earthly and eternal.
It starts out with the viola playing this melody. Do, 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 do. Gorgeous melody. The viola states this whole melody, and then the voice comes in, and you're just in awe of the beauty of this. I personally grew up on the recording of Marian Anderson singing and William Primrose playing the viola part in such a glorious recording. I don't know if that's the first recording that I heard of these pieces, but those are among my favorites, probably is my favorite. And of course, both of them are incredible artists. And Marian Anderson was an icon of the singing in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, I believe. And William Primrose, the great Scottish violist. In the first song, as I said, it starts with the viola, then the voice, and it's repeating some of this material a few times with different lyrics. And in the middle of the first movement, there's this very stormy section. Da-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dee-da-da. And the voice is very agitated. And then we get back to this beautiful, luscious opening section.
Bathed in golden evening light, how solemnly the forests stand. The soft voices of the little birds mingle with the gentle rustle of the evening breeze. What do the winds whisper? They whisper the world into slumber. The stormy middle section shifts both the key and the mood from the gentle atmosphere of the opening. The voice takes on a more agitated rhythm. The viola constantly intertwines with the vocal line, and the piano adds punctuating offbeat chords. The text expresses a restless longing. This song is in ABA form, returning to the piece of the opening. Note the final chords in the piano and double-stopped viola. How gently it falls from the poignant darkness of a diminished seventh chord into a warm slumber of D major. The second, and as mentioned, the earlier composed piece of the set, Sacred Lullaby, sets a text by the German Emanuel Geibel after the Spanish poet Lope de Vega. The poem expresses a tender plea for peace and stillness, as a mother, likely the Virgin Mary, asks angels and nature itself to quiet the world so that her child may rest undisturbed. The piece opens with the viola playing the obbligato melody of the old German cradle song, immediately establishing the sacred maternal context of Mary singing to the infant Jesus. The text reads, "You who hover around these palms in the night and wind, you holy angels, silence the treetops, my child is sleeping." The vocal line that follows is intimate and flowing, like a lullaby. The viola acts both as an echo and an ornament to the singer, while the piano provides a rocking cradle-like accompaniment. Notice the incredibly piercing harmony on the word Nacht, or night.
The second song is very interesting for the viola because Brahms has put the lyrics of the voice in the viola part, I assume, to help the violist to understand, because the violist is starting the song by him or herself playing this melody, and the voice comes in later. So the reason that Brahms did this was to make sure that the violist plays this melody. Da, 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 in a vocal way. That's why he put the lyrics there, which is unusual. You don't normally do that for instrumentalists. As a performer, you might want to write in these lyrics for your study, for your understanding of a work, but the composer would rarely do such a thing. So this second song seems really much like a lullaby, and it was written for the birth of Joachim and his wife's child. And it does have that lullaby feeling, the sort of rocking. You could imagine a cradle being rocked back and forth. There's a stormy section, just like the first song. But then he comes back to this beautiful, relaxing melody that ends it in the most touching, inside way. I've always cherished playing these works because I love the voice. For me, if I didn't play the viola, I would love to be a singer because I just adore the voice. And whenever I have the opportunity to work with voice, I always jump at that.
We also wanted to hear Paul Neubauer's perspective on performing chamber music with vocalists from an instrumentalist's point of view.
The difference between working with instrumentalists and singers is quite pronounced. With instrumentalists, we're working a lot with visual cues, and we can match the strokes of the violin or cello or bass pretty easily because we can see the speed with which the bow is going, and the visual cues are quite clear usually. With the voice, that's harder. Sometimes you're just watching the singer's mouth to see where that syllable is going to be spoken or sung. And it's not that easy because when we speak or we sing, it's not that clear. When you're working with an instrumentalist who gives us a cue by lifting up their instrument or bow and brings it down, it's pretty obvious when you're supposed to play. But if someone is just moving their lips or maybe moving their head a little bit, it's a little more worrisome. Of course, when we work with the piano, quite often the piano will have the rhythmic pulse that we can listen for. When we have the rhythm underneath us, you can just follow that rhythm. But still, you want the singer to feel freedom. You don't want to stifle the artistic excellence of the singer. So you want them to feel free. Normally, you just want to be with the singer and support them. When you're playing an obbligato instrument, it means you're supporting that instrument. Yes, you will have solos, and sometimes the voice will be supporting you, but primarily you're supporting the voice, and you have to be aware and comfortable with that role. And also the range of these songs for the voice, it depends on the singer's range. That's why usually these songs are done with a mezzo-soprano. But, you know, the voice has its limits for the singers. You want them to be comfortable. So if they need a little more space because of their range, you have to accommodate that, of course.
Although Brahms was not a violist himself, he demonstrated a deep affinity for the instrument throughout his life and possessed a profound understanding of its expressive potential, returning to it time and again in his many chamber works. In Zwei Gesänge, Opus 91, he treats the viola as a true second voice, a kindred spirit to the mezzo-soprano, echoing, supporting, and gently conversing with the vocal line.
Next on our program is Dover Beach, a work by the American composer Samuel Barber. It was written in 1931 when Barber was just 21 years old, still a student of piano, voice, and composition at the Curtis Institute. Many of Barber's so-called student works achieved remarkable early success, and the setting of Matthew Arnold's 1867 poem became one of his first published compositions. Barber originally wrote the piece for himself to sing, performing alongside the Curtis String Quartet. The work reflects his rare dual gifts as both composer and baritone. Dover Beach is a haunting meditation on themes of love, loss, and spiritual uncertainty. Choosing a Victorian-era text was a bold move for a young composer, but Barber's deeply lyrical and introspective style proves a perfect match for Arnold's imagery. The quiet pool of the sea, the fading of ancient faith, and the fragile comfort found in human connection. Listen to how the opening line, "The sea is calm tonight," is exquisitely rendered by Barber through musical means. An oscillating, shimmering motif evokes the stillness of the water, punctuated by gentle wave-like gestures. The baritone's expressive line rises and falls like a wave itself, while the string quartet offers not merely accompaniment, but a rich, complex emotional landscape, a glimpse into the inner life of the protagonist. Here's what baritone John Moore shared with us about singing Barber and his songs.
I've sung some of his songs, and he just loves baritones. There's something about that sound world. He knew the bass clef in a way that can tear your heart out. And he writes beautiful melodies above that, but he was ahead of the curve on the baritone voice. Baritones are all the rage now, certainly in opera. There's just a lot of great stuff being written for us. But he gave the baritone voice something beautiful to work with in Dover Beach. His melodies are just haunting and beautiful. There's a sense in Dover Beach of a real melancholy, but there's a hope in it. It's so honest as to be hopeful that we're going to keep going on no matter what happens. And we don't have to sacrifice beauty in the process.
And here's John Moore on Barber's musical depiction of nature and internal turmoil.
The ensemble is the opera of the piece. It's the sea is right there, the crashing on the rocks. And it's just the singer that's telling people what the poet's thinking. It's really the band that's making the picture. And that's why chamber music is so unreal, because it does strip everything away and just says, here, let the music carry this drama. And it needs no setting other than the four instruments and the singer. And in fact, you wouldn't need the singer. If you knew the poem, if you were one of those people that sat in a candlelit room at night and just read Dover Beach over and over, and then just the instrument started playing out of the ether, you would be in that window looking over across to France. Barber clearly spent so much time. He read that poem and heard that music. And that's what the great composers do.
Closing the first half of our program is String Quartet No. 2 for Soprano and Strings, subtitled And Once I Played Ophelia by the Australian composer Brett Dean. Born in 1961, Dean is the leading figure among living composers and is also active as a violist and conductor. As a performer, he spent 15 years with the Berlin Philharmonic before returning to Australia in the year 2000 to devote more time to composition. Since then, he has curated programs for the Sydney Festival and the Melbourne Festival, and his works have been commissioned by major institutions including the Berlin Philharmonic, the Concertgebouw Orchestra, and the Los Angeles Philharmonic, among many others. While his output includes operas, orchestral and vocal works, concertos, and more, chamber music remains the most abundant and perhaps the most personal aspect of his compositional voice. The String Quartet No. 2 is a striking, theatrical, and deeply psychological work based on a text by Matthew Joscelyn, inspired by William Shakespeare's Hamlet. Rather than offering a straightforward setting of Hamlet, the piece unfolds as a psychological monologue, a postmodern reimagining of Ophelia's inner world. Once portrayed as innocent and pure, Ophelia becomes a fractured and tragic figure, spiraling into madness after the death of her father and Hamlet's rejection. Here is Dean describing the text and the conception of the work, and I quote, Matthew Joselyn's text utilizes not only Ophelia's own words from Shakespeare's Hamlet, but also words directed toward or said about her. Through a suite of 5 short movements performed without a break, a concise portrait of Shakespeare's troubled and elusive young character emerges. End quote. The first movement, marked Fast, Breathless, opens with the soprano energetically whispering one of Hamlet's most cutting lines, "Get thee to a nunnery." In Shakespeare's play, this line has a dual meaning. Hamlet may be urging Ophelia to enter a convent for her own protection, or, more darkly, using the word nunnery as a euphemism for brothel, reflecting his growing mistrust and disillusionment. To evoke the urgency and psychological tension of this moment, Brett Dean employs an almost speech-like vocal line filled with whispered and fragmented delivery. Throughout the piece, this string quartet functions as an extension of Ophelia's fractured psyche. The string quartet does not accompany the text in a traditional sense. Rather, it interacts with and often leads the musical narrative, at times echoing the voice, at others foreshadowing or intensifying it. Dean draws on a wide array of extended techniques. Sul ponticello, bowing near the bridge for a glassy metallic sound. Col legno, using the wood of the bow, glissandos, harmonics, and more, all to conjure an oral world that is unstable, volatile, and intensely expressive.
Not getting to a nunnery! A nunnery? Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners?
Without any break, the maddening figuration of the string quartet abruptly fades into near silence, following directly into the second movement, hushed, distant. The texture becomes so subdued that one begins to wonder whether there is still music at all, as the strings are asked to produce barely audible, whispering sound. This extended movement begins with the soprano reciting fragments of Hamlet's love speech to Ophelia, but the words are delivered with long pauses between them, heightening the sense of fragility and tension. The string quartet, playing in an extremely high register, adds to this eerie, suspended atmosphere. The string writing in this movement evokes Ophelia's inner conflict, shifting from delicate whispers to sudden, violent eruptions. The third movement, marked fast, agitated, draws from moments when Ophelia is confronted with her father Polonius's patronizing life instructions. Composer Brett Dean notes that this movement reflects Polonius's controlling presence, quoting lines such as, "This is very ecstasy of love," and "Do not believe his vows," phrases meant to warn and restrain Ophelia.
This is the very ecstasy of love, whose violent remedy for those that live, and leads the way to despair.
The music becomes increasingly chaotic and relentless, with the strings locked in a driving interplay of triplet figurations. After nearly 3 minutes of non-stop directives, intense, insistent, and unyielding, the movement reaches a dramatic full stop. In this moment of exhausted surrender, the soprano releases a big sighing gesture. Then, with haunting resignation, Ophelia speaks the words, "I shall obey my lord." Much like the second movement, the music here uses long pregnant pauses to heighten its emotional volatility. The constant alternation between frenetic textures and near silence gives the work its psychological edge. As the music becomes almost inaudible, the fourth movement, extremely still, begins. This section is based on Queen Gertrude's description of Ophelia's death, and the music stands in stark contrast to the jagged, violent outbursts of the earlier movements. It serves as both an emotional and structural pivot of the work, suspended, ghostly, and profoundly still. A highly evocative cello solo in the high register leads into the final section, slow, austere, which maintains the suspended, weightless atmosphere. Here, Ophelia is at her most distant and fragmented. It is not simply sorrowful, it feels dissociated, as if her voice and self are quietly withdrawing from the world. The soprano sings the chilling line, "Good night." The quartet becomes a kind of sonic memorial, a haunting tribute to the interior life of a character so often silenced. As we saw earlier in Barber's Dover Beach, the combination of voice and string quartet is not unfamiliar. Brett Dean, in his program notes, shared his belief that the drama of a string quartet complemented by a high soprano voice formed a suitable musical metaphor for this ministering angel and the strange beguiling spell she casts over us. Closing the Let's Add Voices program is Leonard Bernstein's Arias and Barcaroles, written for mezzo-soprano, baritone, and piano four hands. Born in 1918 in Massachusetts, Leonard Bernstein was one of the most dynamic and multifaceted musicians of the 20th century, a conductor, composer, pianist, educator, and cultural icon whose influence transcended genre. As the first American-born music director of the New York Philharmonic, he reached millions through televised broadcasts, particularly the young people's concerts, making classical music accessible to a broad audience. As a composer, Bernstein created a remarkably diverse body of work, from Broadway musicals like West Side Story and Candide, to symphonies, choral works, operas, ballets, and chamber music. His music reflects a uniquely American eclecticism, blending jazz, Latin rhythms, Jewish liturgical music, classical tradition, and modernist innovation. Arias and Barcaroles, completed in 1988, was the last work Bernstein assembled, just 2 years before his death. While the cycle was finalized late in life, some of its songs had earlier origins, with sketches dating back to the 1950s. Over time, Bernstein reworked and expanded the set, eventually creating the collected version we hear nowadays. All but one of the texts were written by Bernstein himself. The cycle unfolds as a series of 8 short pieces, touching on the everyday joys, complexities, ironies, and vulnerabilities of love and domestic life. Rather than following a narrative arc, the songs form a witty and tender mosaic. The title, Arias and Barcaroles, has its own story. After a White House concert in 1960, where Bernstein performed Mozart's Piano Concerto and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, President Dwight D. Eisenhower reportedly told him, "You know, I like that last piece you played. It's got a theme. I like music with a theme. Not all them arias and barcaroles." Bernstein, with characteristic wit, later recalled, "Right away I noted that down as a title to use someday." The first song of the cycle, Prelude, opens with contrasting sonorities. The piano introduces a jagged, angular figuration with sharp accents, soon followed by the voice repeatedly declaring, "I love you." In an ironic twist, the performers are instructed to deliver the phrase without expression. The emotional flatness, paired with dissonant textures, undercuts the sentimentality typically associated with those words. The second song, Love Duet, is not the soaring romantic exchange one might expect. Instead, it satirizes the clichés of coupledom. The two voices bicker and tease, and the music mirrors this dry humor with a simple, almost hypnotic melody, echoed and imitated between the piano and the voices, much like the back and forth in the text. Third song, Little Smarry, is based on a childhood story Bernstein's mother used to tell him, and is dedicated to his sister, Shirley Ann Bernstein. The poem recounts the tale of a little girl, Little Smarry, who loses and eventually finds her beloved stuffed rabbit on the windowsill. The musical setting is compact and expressionistic, full of angular leaps, dissonance, and fleeting gestures, evoking the sound world of composers like Webern and Berg.
And cried and cried and cried.
fourth song, Love of My Life, is a baritone solo that paints a bitter and ironic portrait of a man reflecting on a failed relationship. The song opens with the resigned line, "The love of my life was not the love of my life." Half of the piece is occupied by a sparse, searching piano introduction that seems directionless and fragmented. When the voice enters, the music shifts dramatically, oscillating between dry humor and quiet despair. Bernstein uses jazz-inflected harmonies, biting dissonances, and rhythmic instability to mirror the psychological unraveling of the speaker.
Of my life was not the love of my life may still arrive tonight, or maybe not.
The fifth song, Greeting, offers a rare moment of sincerity and emotional warmth in the cycle. Bernstein composed this lullaby-like piece in 1955, upon the birth of his son, Alexander Serge Bernstein. The text opens, "When a boy is born, the world is born again," and the music unfolds as a gentle cradle song.
When a boy is born, the world is born again, and takes its first breath.
The sixth song, At My Wedding, is set to a Yiddish poem by Yankev Yitzchok Segal. The poem tells of a young musician at a wedding, initially dismissed by the guests, who ends up moving the entire crowd to joyous dancing through the power of his music. The song's folkloric tone, rhythmic vitality, and vocal inflections evoke both humor and cultural memory. Bernstein dedicated this piece to Michael Tilson Thomas, whom he regarded as a kind of musical son, and who, together with Bernstein, was one of the two pianists at the premiere performance in 1988. The seventh song, Mr. and Mrs. Webb Say Goodnight, is based on a real-life incident. During a visit to Indiana in 1982, Bernstein befriended Mr. Webb, the dean of the Indiana University School of Music. The song portrays Mr. and Mrs. Webb trying to calm down their two sons and put them to bed amidst the chaos of everyday family life. With his signature flair for musical theater, Bernstein captures the humor and warmth of a relatable domestic scene filled with playful energy and conversational back and forth. Final song of the cycle, Nachspiel, German for postlude or epilogue, contains no text. Instead, the two singers hum dreamily along with a lyrical, introspective piano texture. The song is marked with the dedication In Memoriam. Thank you. The closing section of Nachspiel subtly recalls material from one of Bernstein's earlier songs, First Love for My Mother, composed in 1986. The original text reads, "My first love, Jenny B, 88, young to me. My second love is 88 too, 88 keys that sing to you. Thus do I dedicate 88 to my first two loves." Although Nachspiel does not include these words, its intimate, tender atmosphere and the use of wordless voice strongly suggest a hidden dedication to Bernstein's mother. This concludes our discussion of Concert Program 6, Let's Add Voices. A special thank you to Amy Koda for her immense help in procuring the audio samples, to the organizations who provided access to their catalogs, and to the artists who agreed to share their thoughts on the music. I'm Dmitry Atapin.
And this is Heian Park. Many thanks for listening, and we truly hope to see you at all the concerts.
Audio notes are written and produced by Dmitry Atapin and Heian Park in consultation with David Finkel and Wuhan. Many thanks to the baritone John Moore for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Weber selected Scottish national songs for voice, flute, violin, cello, and piano, performed by John Moore, baritone, Tara Helen O'Connor, flute, Annie Kavafian, violin, Nicholas Kanelakis, cello, and Gloria Chien, piano, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Brahms' Zwei Gesänge, Opus 91, performed by Sarah Kuden, contralto, Arno Zussmann, viola, and Gilbert Kalish, piano, courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Barber Dover Beach for voice and string quartet, Opus 3, performed by Yun Peng Wang, baritone, Kristen Lee and Danby violins, Matthew Lipman, viola, and David Finkel, cello, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Dean, quartet number 2 for soprano and strings, and Once I Played Ophelia, performed by Tony Arnold, soprano, and the Orion String Quartet, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Bernstein arias and barcaroles, performed by Tamara Mumford, mezzo-soprano, Nathan Gunn, baritone, Anne-Marie McDermott, and Sebastian Knauer, pianos, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.